I'm Evan Smith, CEO and Editor-in-Chief of the Texas Tribune. I'm joined today by Dan Bartlett, former counselor to President Bush, former communications director for President Bush, now president of Public Strategies. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Thanks
Glad
for being
to be
here.
With you.
So we are a year out from Barack Obama being elected president, the Democrats regaining the majority in the Senate and taking, in fact, a big majority, mm-hmm. picking up a number of seats in the House. A lot of concern back then that the Republican Party was in a bad place. Not so today, but questions remain. Republicans in popularity polls don't do much better than Democrats in Congress. What's going on with the Republican Party now, your Republican Party?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I don't think a Republican right now can get a lot of hope or optimism based on what's happened to the current president, because I think the American people look at these two issues separately. In the first 2 years of a presidency, it is very much a referendum on that president. And I think Barack Obama and his team are learning that it's a lot more difficult to govern than it is to campaign. And we've seen that in the sense also because when they entered into office, they entered when there was a huge crisis going on in the financial markets. And what we learned during the post 9/11 crisis is that the American people rallied towards the government and the leader of that government. As that crisis has subsided somewhat, the typical realities of trying to do business in Washington have come to the fore, and the administration has had some difficulties. But you're absolutely right. The Republicans may gain in the short term, but the American people's attitude towards them really hasn't changed since the election. In fact, recent public opinion polling shows that self-identified Republicans are down to historic lows in the low 20s. And that's something that should be a real concern. My only point to that would be is that Republicans shouldn't lose patience. It's going to be very difficult to turn the needle, to turn the dial on that perspective or their reputation, so to speak, until this first 2 years of this presidency is underway, because the public is more interested in understanding what the new president's going to do than what the opposition is up to.
You were with a president whose midterm in his first term elections, midterm elections were atypical. Typically in their first term, the party in the White House would lose seats in Congress.
That's correct.
Your boss and your party actually did better, unusually so. What should Republicans look to next year for 2010? Obviously, they're hoping to pick up seats back in the House and the Senate, maybe regain majorities in one of those houses, although that seems unlikely.
I think that's right. I do believe that we return to the historical norm in which the sitting president loses seats from his own party. I don't think it'll be of historic proportions in which they change the power of the House or the Senate for that matter. I do believe that it could be largely based upon where the economy stands and where the job situation is. You could see 40 to 50 seats. It could be a big night for Republicans.
But still not regain the majority.
That I don't see that right now. Now, there's an enormous amount of time between now and to that point, the president could rally if the economic conditions continue to improve and the American people feel those improvements. And that's always been the challenge in politics, is that right. An economic recovery statistically happens before the public actually feels it.
Feels the effects. We're sitting here the day before Election Day when a congressional seat in upstate New York will be decided. We have a conservative party candidate who has managed to get the Republican Party candidate out of the race. She has since endorsed the Democratic Party candidate. This is being described as an example of the problems that the Republicans are having right now nationally. There is a civil war going on, it is said, between the very conservative wing and the more establishment or moderate wing of the Republican parties. And there are people who believe that, a lot of people believe, in fact, that this is not necessarily good for the Republican Party to have this kind of a fight. Talk about that. From your perspective as a Republican, who frankly saw his boss attacked by other Republicans occasionally in the White House, is this a good thing for the Republicans to have going on or a bad thing?
Well, I would start by saying let's not draw too many conclusions from one race in New York in which there was a pretty messy process in which they selected their candidates, whereby, you know, the different qualities of the candidates and abilities are pretty significant. No question that there's a tension within the Republican Party with regards to what should be its principal cause or what it should really put forward as its fundamental philosophy and the type of candidates it approaches. Republicans are always most successful when they can get a broad enough tent to include all the parties, factions, whether it be your fiscal conservatives, your social conservatives, or your moderates or foreign policy hawks. We have to find a message and a philosophy that includes all of them, because increasingly, as we see, is that Republican identification and Democratic identification is down. Is that independents and others are going to continue to control the destiny of the two parties. And you have to be attractive enough at the end of the day, if you're going to win nationally. Now, in congressional races in certain places, you may be able to pull that off. But it's my sense is that the party is always best when it can attract people from all walks of life and from all perspectives to the extent possible, without obviously undermining principle and undermining core values.
So when Republicans talk about Charlie Crist as a Republican in name only in Florida, or they talk about other Republicans around the country as too moderate for the Republican Party, that would seem to cut against the idea that the party has to be inclusive enough to include independents in the calculation.
I think that's right. I think that we've got enough on our hands in taking on the Democrats and others. Why we choose as a party to attack our fellow Republicans because they don't follow lockstep with every position you take, I think for the long term is a mistake. I think we are better served by having robust, contested primaries, let the best person come forward and win and articulate their views. But particularly on the national level, we're seeking national leadership in which there's so many different constituencies and perspectives. I think we will paint ourselves into a corner that will be hard to leave in the many years to come if we don't have a more inclusive approach.
Well, let's take this idea and bring it down to the state level here in Texas and the governor's race, the primary for governor in the Republican Party between Rick Perry and Kay Bailey Hutchison. This is being seen nationally as a proxy for the civil war going on in the Republican Party. I would observe that only in Texas would Kay Bailey Hutchison seem moderate. She's a fairly conservative person, but you do have this debate going on, and the Perry people are trying to come at this from the right of Senator Hutchison and argue that some of the votes she's taken in Congress and some of the positions she's held for a long time are simply too moderate for the Republican Party of Texas. Do you believe that Senator Hutchison has a problem with Republicans in Texas in terms of where she fits on the ideological spectrum?
Well, I think if you look at her favorability ratings and those things, I think she is in good stead with the Republican Party in general, and specifically matched up against Governor Perry, he tends to do better. He has a very specific strategy with regards to turnout and to make that clear distinction. One thing that I think is he benefits by is the public's and in Texas disgust of what's going on in Washington, and painting Senator Hutchison as a part of that has been a strategy that they've executed fairly well in the last several months. But I think that's somewhat of a false choice to say that nationally people ought to look at Texas and say this is really where they're deep divide, because as you say, their positions on the two issues aren't as far apart as
it's not as if Governor Perry is running against Lincoln Chafee.
Right.
You know,
she's
much more of a concern. Now, the Bushies, to the degree that there is still such an entity, seem to be with her. You've got Karen Hughes out openly supporting her. You've got Karl Rove, maybe a little bit less overtly, seeming to be with her. Vice President Cheney has now come out and endorsed Senator Hutchison. There's even talk that President Bush might be, if not out in the open, and at least in secret for her, and suggesting that, you know, the best strategy for her might not be to resign, that she should stay in the Senate. And in any case, they sense that the Bush folks are for her. Have you taken a position on this race?
I have not, and I am going to attempt to stay as much as Switzerland as possible. But look.
Is there a Bushy deal for her to the degree that we should read this as the Bushes don't like, the Bush crowd doesn't like Perry?
I don't believe so.
I
think there'll be other people who will come out and support Governor Perry.
Are there any Bush close people who you know are supporting Perry?
I've heard people who do come from that perspective, or at least who were Bush people who are going to support Governor Perry. So I wouldn't overstate that. Some of these people has personal relationships. You mentioned Karen Hughes and others who they've had with Senator Hutchison. And to be clear, President Bush is staying on the sidelines. He is not trying to orchestrate any of this.
He will not officially take a position
That's
on
correct.
This at any point.
That's correct.
I'm sure his endorsement would be welcomed by one side or the other.
Probably so.
In Texas.
Probably so.
Let's talk about some of the national issues that have a bearing on this state. It is known, the state with the most uninsured people in the country.
Yep.
We have certain segments of our population that are the most uninsured in the country, and that I think it's children and seniors, a couple of others. We have a health care reform process going on now in Washington. Messy, but it's going on.
Right.
Why shouldn't Texans, who are in such great numbers, uninsured be generally supportive of a reform effort that might result in care for them and their families?
Well, it's interesting that you start with the question of the uninsured, and I think this is actually where the administration themselves kind of got bollocksed up politically, because while there are large swaths of the American people who are without insurance, including the state of Texas, there's far more who have insurance, who feel threatened by the very reforms that are being discussed or is going to somehow undermine the quality of care they're getting. So you saw the administration pivot away from, as much as possible, from the early days of selling this health reform package to the quality of insurance and the cost of insurance for people who already have it. And I think what they found, and what you're going to find here in the state of Texas, is that the bigger political threat, and we'll get to the public policy point in a second, but from a political perspective, there are more people who feel like they have something to lose by insuring more people than they do from keeping the status quo.
Why is that?
Because I believe that the philosophy, or at least the way it's been described, is that with a more government intervention into the insurance market in an attempt to cover more people is going to somehow dilute the quality of care and increase the cost of that care for those who already are satisfied. Because remember, as much as we don't like insurance companies, and you can see the public opinion polls that show that, it is almost that old dynamic that you see with members of Congress. We hate the Congress, but I like
my
congressman.
I like my guy, right. Yeah.
Same thing goes with your health care, is that I don't like those big, bad insurance companies, but I'm pretty satisfied. And you see across the board a high 70% approval of people's own health insurance. So, and that's part of the problem that we have. We've grown up now in this $10 copay culture in which it's pretty easy, because all the costs and all those things are being dealt by third parties, is that the price sensitivity of healthcare has been, the consumer has been shielded by that. So you have a situation now where I think while we would like to see more people insured, we'd only like to see that if it doesn't do anything to my own insurance. And that's been the challenge that you've seen from a standpoint of how the administration has rolled this out, how they have tried to communicate what they're doing against a backdrop in which, while healthcare is important, most people are worried about whether they're going to have a job or not. And I think part of the issue that the administration has found themselves in is this notion that they're trying to do too much too fast. I found that the way that they've dealt with the economy is that they passed the stimulus package, and it was almost like, check the box. We've done that. Let's move on. Whereas the public's mind, even though they saw this stimulus package passed, A, they may not agreed with it. B, they might not be feeling the effects of it. And C, they're still very threatened by the fact of whether they're going to lose their job or whether they can find a job if they've already lost it. Right. And so that's kind of the backdrop in which they've tried to enter into this health care debate. And it's one where they've had to find themselves modulating how they present it to the American people.
Of course, the end of the Bush administration featured government action much like the action that the early Obama administration had to take to get the economy stable. In theory, you all might be in a very similar position to where the Obama folks are if you were still in office now, right, in terms of the stimulus.
Absolutely.
Right. And but you're saying you might have administered it differently. Once past the stimulus, you might have done more to focus specifically on that and push some of this other stuff to the side.
Well, that's, I mean, not only, you know, the stimulus package, then they had three other balls in the air: healthcare reform, environmental energy reform, financial regulatory reform, which you could argue is a part of the financial crisis. So it was just one of the, in the sense that they'd all had to get done now. Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff to the president, was famous to quote to say, don't let a good crisis go to waste. That might be come back to haunt them, because people felt, while that might have been a smart legislative strategy, right, from a broader perspective of trying to articulate to the American people what you're trying to do and how you're doing it, it felt like they were going too fast.
How much of this is a cost issue, the concern that the health care reform activity in Washington may not be paid for? And answer that, please, in the context of what you all did with prescription drug reform. Mm-hmm. My memory is that there was a push for that. There wasn't a whole lot of concern about how that would be paid for. So why is that any different than this?
Well, actually, there was. I mean, we lost a lot of support. I would say that if you look within the own Republican Party, and where a lot of the conservatives really never got over the fact of the president signing off, championing, and then ultimately signing off on the prescription drug package that he passed. The irony is that while all the estimates were saying that it was going to cost so much more, $500 billion was one of the estimates at the time, we have found by entering a market force into prescription drugs is that it has come down enormously from where it was. Now, fast forward to today, in the situation they found themselves on, it was really kind of It was a double-barrel shotgun that the administration received early in last spring, early summer. First, it was the sticker shock of the stimulus package and the nature of the package. I mean, I think that was really one of the things where the White House had a big misstep. Many parts or elements of Barack Obama's candidacy was based upon doing things differently in Washington. And I think there was the first big piece of legislation that was really going to define the early days of the White House was a stimulus package that was pretty much given over to the Congress to run, Speaker Pelosi and Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader. And it seemed very traditional, very kind of typical pork barrel projects, you know, spending that, a lot of it, there was a lot of highlighting of spending that didn't really have to do with economic activity. So there you have that kind of, wait a minute. Then on top of that, when the Congressional Budget Office came out with that first big devastating report about what the House package, insurance package, was going to look like from a standpoint of budget deficits and that it couldn't pay for itself, that really put them in a hole right out of the gate.
Some time ago, a couple weeks ago, we were together last, you said that you believed there was about a 60-40 chance that health care reform would pass by the end of the year. A couple weeks later, a lot has happened. Senate has decided to put a public option, modified public option, into its bill with an opt-out for states. What do you think now? What's your percentage chance of a health care bill passing by the end of the year?
A bill passing, yeah, I think it has increased. And I think a calculation has been made by Senate House Democrats as well as with the White House that doing nothing would cost them more politically than doing something. What that something was going to be is what is still left to be said. There's been enormous amount of focus on the quote-unquote public option, but there are a lot of other elements to this bill that I don't think they've figured out the end game on. So I would say it's probably greater than a 60% opportunity for passage. Whether it'll be more incremental and then sold as fundamental, we will see. I think where he missed the mark, or at least a lesson that I learned from two big domestic initiatives that President Bush attempted to enact and failed, Social Security reform and immigration reform, is that the model for legislative lawmaking, for congressional lawmaking, has been pass a bill in the House that is further to the left if you're a Democrat or to the right if you're a Republican, move it to the Senate, let that kind of water it down a bit, and then move to a conference committee in which there's some sort of negotiation and everybody walks out and joins hands. The problem with that on an issue that is so contentious, whether it be Social Security reform or how we learned on immigration reform and now health care reform, the politics of it are not only partisan, but they're geographic. There are many different elements or components that make it very difficult to pass. And it's my sense is that what happens is because since you start on one radical side, you know, the principle that, you know, first impressions are lasting impressions. This whole healthcare debate was defined by that first, the first elements of that first package passed out of the House. And the White House found itself in a precarious situation where I'm not really endorsing it, I'm endorsing the process, but not the substance. We did the exact same thing on Social Security, did the exact same thing on immigration. What you have to do, and I was talking to a former colleague who was more closely related to the legislative and policy deal-making on that set, is that it would have been wiser, if you could pull it off politically, is to cut the deal on the front end. What you usually wait till the conference deal on the back end, you got to cut on the front end, build a coalition of Republicans and Democrats, and then all jump together and define it from the outset. As opposed to doing it in reverse order.
Was that ever going to happen in this case, though? I know that the president tried to get Republicans to come to the table, but it seemed as if, other than Senator Snowe, and maybe not even Senator Snowe, that he's not going to get any Republican votes.
The same thing happened to us in the sense of you invited him over for watch a movie at the White House, a lot of, you know, happy talk. We did the same thing. But at the end of the day, you could clearly see whether you're Republican sitting in the White House this year with this team, or whether you're a Democratic congressman or senator sitting with our White House team and congressional Republicans, then is that they were going to dictate what was in this legislation out of the gate. You're going to be a marginal player at best. And it's only my point to say that if you're going to do something big and fundamental on a big issue like this, in which having public support for it is just as important as the actual elements of the bill, I don't think you can follow that traditional process.
Doesn't the fact that now a majority of the public, an overwhelming majority of the public, supports a public option matter in all this?
And, you know, I don't think so, because I think that is the general support for the healthcare reform is still below 50%.
Right.
The public option may have more support than it has opposition, but not by much. And I think that as much as it's being defined by that, will obscure many other elements of the legislation that could be proved to be even more controversial on behalf of those who actually pass it. So I'm not convinced that at the end of the day, if a Democratic-only piece of legislation is passed, it's going to find itself, which will have, remind you, all kinds of very long effective dates, which may give opportunities after the midterm election and others for there to be votes to dial stuff back. At the end of the day, this may not be, that's why I'm saying whether it's going to be incremental or fundamental, I think it's too early to tell.
Okay. Let's switch gears for a second. If you had advised Senator Cornyn or Senator Hutchison during the debate over Sonia Sotomayor's nomination to the Supreme Court, having lived through a number of Supreme Court nominations yourself in the White House,
mm-hmm.
and having advocated, no doubt, the belief that the president gets to make qualified nominations and that the advice and consent function of the Senate is appropriate, but at the end of the day, the president should get his nominees.
That's right.
Would you have advised them to vote for Senator for the nominee for Sotomayor in this case, as an acknowledgement of the historic aspects of it, and with the knowledge that back home there are Hispanics in Texas who are looking to them on, you know, for votes that would signal their point of view on this?
Right. Look, there's no one who is more frustrated about what I think is somewhat of a double standard, is that when a conservative candidate's put forward, you have to look at more than just the fact that they're conservative leanings. The sitting president, Barack Obama, voted against Chief Justice John Roberts,
and
who was one of the most qualified.
And Sam Alito, right?
And Sam Alito, to that extent. The most qualified ever to be put forward. Setting aside that double standard, I do think that Republicans, that she was qualified. Do we agree with her worldview? No. But that's what elections are about. And when the president puts forward somebody who's qualified, I think you ought to vote for him. In addition to that, obviously, was the backdrop of the fact that it was a Latina woman, somebody who I'm sure is greatly admired in the Latina community. And needless to say, that probably set back yet again efforts by the Republican Party to make real, honest, and authentic inroads. Everybody does the outreach during election cycle, but I think the Hispanic community sees through that. I think those candidates and those elected leaders that not only begin a dialogue, a consistent dialogue, but does it in a way that seems authentic, are the ones who are going to prove to be successful in attracting the Hispanic vote.
There is a sense that the Republican Party has not been sufficiently attentive to the Hispanic community, and there is a fear by some Republicans that that vote's going to tilt largely Democratic and maybe even turn a red state like Texas blue in an election cycle or two.
Right.
What's the reality here, and what's your prescription for the Republicans?
Well, the demographics are startling. I mean, if you look at the past 5 years, fastest net population growth, one of the fastest birth rates, lowest mortality rates. Texas is a vibrant, growing state, largely because of the growth of the Hispanic population in the state. 60% of the increase in population in the last 5 years is attributable to Hispanics. That number, going forward, is only going to multiply, in the sense that most people would say, demographers will say, by 2025, roughly, is when Hispanics will be the dominant population in the state of Texas. So the question politically really is, and they're not monolithic, but which party is best positioned for that reality? Because whoever is going to dominate politics in Texas for the next generation. And I would say right now, based on the previous debate we had on immigration under George W. Bush nationally, and based on where candidates in the Republican Party are positioning themselves statewide and locally, is that we are handing over politics, the power of seat of government in the state of Texas, to Democrats for years to come. I think we are losing a great opportunity in which the Hispanic, the typical Hispanic family, has a lot of similarities and a lot of issues or worldview in which resonates with the Republican philosophy of entrepreneurism, of values. There's a lot of room there to develop a authentic relationship with the Hispanic community going forward politically. But I don't think anybody right now at the statewide level that I have seen is demonstrating that, or demonstrating the type of earnest, authentic outreach that will better position this party going forward. In fact, I think we're taking positions on issues such as on the immigration debate that is setting the party back many, many years.
Texas ranks very high on the list of states with the most people deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and also with the most casualties. You have a lot of families in Texas who've had members of their family, fathers and sons, mothers and daughters, and all that overseas fighting these wars for a number of years now. And you invariably have some who would just like to see their family members come home.
That's right.
As the president considers what to do with General McChrystal's recommendation in Afghanistan, how do you look, say, a mom from San Benito in the eye and tell her this is a war we still need to continue fighting, and so we need to keep your son overseas longer? Doesn't her frustration at how long this has taken, or her desire to see her family member come home and the war come to an end, the U.S. come home, where does that all weigh into the calculation? What should we be doing right now?
Well, to draw on the very last experience, really, that I had in the White House, the last big decision I was involved in was the surge of additional troops and a change of strategy for counterinsurgency strategy in Iraq. Going through that policy process and political process was obviously very sobering on a lot of different levels. The hardest part about that was knowing that at the end of the day we were about to make a decision that the majority of the American people didn't support, majority of the world didn't support. And we knew, and it actually didn't turn out to be the case, but all the estimates at the time was that the strategy that we were putting into place was going to put more soldiers at risk, not less. Because the whole change of strategy is to protect the population. Therefore, the troops had to spend more time in the cities, communities throughout Iraq to protect them, meaning they weren't going to be back on their compounds 60 miles outside of Baghdad or Mosul or wherever it may be. A very similar conversation now is taking place with the issues in Afghanistan. And while there are some fundamental differences between the two, the challenge this White House has now, and it's a White House that, and a president who is always strives, it seems, to try to find that, hey, I know the smart way that can kind of be the middle ground. I think what they're learning through this process is that there's not really a middle ground, and that trying to shape war policy to current public opinion is impossible. It just is impossible. And to the point of your question, I found it more times than not that the conversations you'd have with military families is that they were more concerned that their kid was going to had already lost their life for a war that was fought in vain, or that they are being sent over there and they don't have a strategy that the commander-in-chief has confidence in. What is going to be most important, whatever he does, is that he demonstrate to the public and to the military and to the enemy and to all those who I call the fence sitters around the world, Russia, China. There's a lot of people. I mean, we know our enemies are watching. We always talk about that. I oftentimes am more interested in those who kind of sit on the fence, kind of seeing where the trends globally are going to go. Is America up or down? Do we side with them or not? Those are all the audiences who are going to be looking at this young president as he makes this decision. And it seems to me is that whatever he does, he's going to have to demonstrate his convictions about it being the right policy, whether it means a full-throated counterinsurgency policy, whether they decide to do it in certain regions. But whatever it is, I think the way he presents it is going to be critical to its ultimate success.
Okay, last question. Let's talk about the Nobel Peace Prize. The assumption here is that the award of the prize was not to President Obama, but to President not Bush.
Right.
Do you subscribe to that theory?
Yeah, I do. But it was kind of a shock when you first see it, but I obviously, as somebody who's from a conservative perspective, and you look back over who's received it over the course of the last 50, 60 years, not really surprised in some respects. I got to admit, I bet you the White House at that moment and where they stood politically was the last thing they wanted.
They wished it hadn't happened.
Yeah. I mean, you want it, you always want it.
But it plays into the narrative, right? The narrative coming out against them.
Yeah. But there's probably no one else more irritated by it. Not George W. Bush, but the 42nd President of the United States, Bill Clinton. Here's a guy who was very frustrated, who tried on the Middle East peace process, the Ireland peace process, all these things, and then all the work that he's done with his
humanitarian
efforts since then. And he's like, here's a guy who can't get a break. And this young guy who they had a very tense relationship with during the Democratic primary process with his wife, and here he is not even. They had to make the decision before he'd even really taken office. I mean, the committee, if I understand it correctly.
They decided after about a month, right?
Yeah, after a month. And he's like, I mean, so old George W. is used to getting kicked around by the elites and by the liberal elites, and particularly from overseas. And the one who's probably more frustrated by it is old Bill Clinton.
Okay. Dan Bartlett, thanks very much.
It's my pleasure.
Okay.